is the news.
Iran's leader hails the Iranian Navy's first round-the-world voyage, saying that a move has contributed to the country's security. Russia and Ukraine intensify attacks against each other as talks on the war, hosted by Saudi Arabia, conclude with no final declaration. In Japan, marking the 78th anniversary of the U.S. atomic bombing of Hiroshima, amid growing calls for the abolition of nuclear weapons. Tom Behrouz, Najafi, it's good to have you with us. Now, starting with comments by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, hailing the round-the-globe mission of the 86th Naval Flotilla as a boost to national security. In a meeting with the flotilla's personnel and their families, Ayatollah Sayyid Khamenei said that the presence of the flotilla in remote waters helped prop up Iran's security. He added that the expedition showed that open seas belong to everyone, not just superpowers like the U.S. Iran's leader also stressed that Americans launch acts on oil tankers and help maritime smugglers both in the region and beyond. This, he says, is a breach of an international law of humanity, as maritime security should be ensured for all nations. The Iranian Navy's 86th flotilla completed its journey around the world on the 20th of May. Now, Kyiv has launched a new attack on Russian-controlled Donbas region after Moscow hit Ukrainian facilities in Zaporizhia and Kharkiv. Russian officials say the Ukraine hit Donetsk University building with cluster shells, causing widespread damage. Moscow's mayor also saying that Russian air defenses have destroyed a drone over the capital. Ukraine has reported has shot down dozens of cruise missiles and drones, Kyiv saying that Russia hit a factory that makes plane and helicopter engines, as well as a blood transfusion center, leaving casualties. The latest developments on the ground come as peace talks in the Saudi city of Jeddah have concluded with no final declaration. Some 40 countries attended the summit, but a meeting excluded Russia. John Emitter says that Ukraine using cluster munitions in civilian areas is alarming.
I'm in Donetsk for a couple of days, and last night at about 10 o'clock, we heard incoming. Which isn't unusual. It's very usual, in fact, for the center of for Donetsk. But after the initial explosion, we heard a number of smaller explosions, almost like fireworks. It's thought that this is the use of cluster munitions. It turned out the target was a university building, a trade and economy building. It's only a couple of blocks away from where I am now. As I said, striking at the center of Donetsk is far from unusual. What is unusual is directed in a university building, an architecturally important building, and such a target is unusual. These allegations of cluster munitions being used in Donetsk is certainly a very alarming, alarming event.
Esha Krishnaswamy is a podcaster and journalist. She joined us earlier from St. Petersburg and said that Ukraine will remain bogged down in the war as long as the U.S. and NATO back the conflict.
Unfortunately, we have to remember that Ukraine is not a completely sovereign country in that they don't direct their own foreign policy. The policies are directed by NATO and U.S., and they will toe the line. So we have to wonder when the U.S. and NATO will realize that this is a futile war, and I don't see it happening. And Russia's strategy is a war of attrition, where they're trying to deplete the weapons caches of Ukraine and neighboring NATO countries like Poland. And so it is a war of attrition, and I don't see it ending anytime soon, barring some kind of major realization. And as we know, about a year ago, Turkey tried to make a peace deal with Russia and Ukraine, and it was sabotaged by then UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson. So as long as US, UK, and NATO are committed to this war, Ukraine is kind of have their hands tied, and they're not going to be able to get out of this, regardless of what the government thinks and what the public thinks.
Japan is remembering the victims of the U.S. atomic bombing of Hiroshima in the final days of the Second World War. Some 140,000 people were killed in what was the first ever use of nuclear weapons in the war. We've discussed that issue in our news review program.
Time now for the news review of this bulletin. Japan has marked the 78th anniversary of the U.S. atomic bombing of Hiroshima.
Mokutou!
Hundreds of white doves, considered symbols of peace, were released and wreaths were laid at the memorial site. In an address at the ceremony, the Hiroshima mayor urged the abolition of nuclear weapons, calling the notion of nuclear deterrence a folly. The U.S. dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima in 1945 during World War II. It killed 140,000 by the end of the year. The U.S. dropped a second bomb 3 days later on Nagasaki, which killed 70,000 more. Many survivors of the bombings have lasting injuries and illnesses resulting from the explosions and radiation exposure. The U.S. has never apologized for the bombings. To this day, it remains the only country to have used nuclear weapons. Barry Grossman is an international lawyer joining us from Bali, Indonesia. John Stepling, author and commentator, joins us from Inderøy, Norway. Welcome to you both. I'll start with you, Barry Grossman. You know, it's a cliche to say what lessons has the U.S. learned, but that question needs to be asked when this anniversary comes about, because we still know that the U.S. is in the possession of nuclear weapons. Do you think that the U.S. has done enough to eradicate nuclear weapons as a whole?
Let's be clear about one thing. The United States has right. The Second World War, a policy of limited war with the specific purpose of preparing to fight the Soviet Union and more recently the Russians and the Chinese. And that policy was formally embraced until 1974 with special units developed, armed to deploy short-range nuclear shells on the battlefield. Before the policy was modified or abandoned in 74, but more recently, of course, it's been picked up again with Congress now talking about funding pocket nukes and the like. More importantly, or equally importantly, the U.S. has essentially completely destroyed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, except when it's invoked in order to lord it over countries which the U.S. portrays as the enemy. So, no, they certainly have not done enough, and in fact, you know, they haven't even come clean yet about what the true reasons behind the bombing of Japan were. It was a great tragedy, but I think to this day, there's not a great deal of sympathy in the world, bearing in mind the havoc that was wreaked by Japan on the world during World War II, fully supported by the Japanese population. So there's a whole range of issues which sort of converge, but if we bring it back to the core question which you asked, has the U.S. done enough to acknowledge the horrors of what happened and to stop it from happening again, I'd say quite the opposite is true. And certainly there are many analysts who are now saying we've never been at greater risk of a full-on nuclear proliferation since at the very least the Cuban missile crisis than we are right now with the U.S. running interference in order to get the Ukrainians to fight this proxy war against the great unbeatable giant in the form of Russia.
You don't have to own nuclear weapons, but provoking other nations that have the nuclear weapons is, I think, your opinion matters just as bad. And I'm talking in reference to you, not only Russia in the case of Ukraine, but also North Korea. So why does the U.S. pursue that path?
Well, I think probably the short answer is because the United States is being led by sociopaths. But look, the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima and a couple of days later on Nagasaki, civilian cities, was unjustified from a military standpoint. It was a political act to frighten Stalin and the Soviet Union. The entirety of U.S. military leadership, even Curtis LeMay, were against it, said there was no reason for it, were saw it as a reckless act that would have long-range repercussions. The bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki is something that is the United States is very overdue to apologize for, and yet, just the other day, Anthony Blinken, speaking of sociopaths, commented that climate change was really no different than nuclear war. This lack of this tone deafness, this lack of rational perspective and understanding of the tragedy that was Hiroshima is terrifying. We also have the sort of the musings of celebrities, the alcoholic movie stars like Sean Penn, who say, it's an overcautious discussion of nuclear weapons. What can that possibly mean? I don't understand people who utter these things, who do not understand the magnitude of the crime that was Hiroshima, and 2 days later Nagasaki, which was only Nagasaki was bombed just to test out and compare, you know, the different recipes for the bomb. There were a million ways to stop the war in its entirety. Japan was ready to surrender. There were ways to demonstrate the bomb where you didn't have to drop it on a civilian city, but on and on and on. The point is, this is the American leadership has learned nothing at all. The proxy war in Ukraine is evidence of that, and we just had a report about the munition cluster bombs being shipped off to Ukraine. The U.S. Protects allies like Israel that have a nuclear arsenal. They get excised over countries they don't approve of having a nuclear arsenal, like North Korea. They are constantly using Iran getting the nuke, who has no intentions of getting a nuclear weapon, but they use that as an excuse for more saber rattling and sanctions. The U.S. is the force for destabilization in the world. But the point here is, on the anniversary of Hiroshima, it is time that the U.S. does apologize, recognize the magnitude of that crime, the horror of dropping that bomb. It's just, you know, it leaves one speechless that this has never been addressed, but then the U.S. has never apologized for anything.
With that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review.
Welcome back. The North Korean leader has instructed factories making missile engines, artillery, and other weaponry to boost their capacity as an important part of bolstering his country's defense capabilities. Kim Jong-un issued the instruction while inspecting, from Thursday to Saturday, the production of military hardware. His unusual visits to several arms production facilities come as Pyongyang is pushing to develop strategic weapons and holds prominent displays of a range of arms. Tensions remain high in the Korean Peninsula amid a standoff between North Korea and the U.S. Pyongyang has warned Washington over holding military exercise in the region, and recently over its new weapons package for Taiwan. A passenger train is derailed in Pakistan's southern Sindh province, killing at least 30 people and injuring 80. 8 train cars went off the tracks near the town of Nawabshah, roughly 300 kilometers from the largest city of Karachi. At least 1,000 passengers were aboard the train. Wounded passengers have been moved to nearby hospitals. Rescue teams are trying to free people from the twisted wreckage. The railway minister has raised the possibility of a mechanical fault, but has not ruled out sabotage. Pakistan has seen a string of deadly train accidents over the past years. In June 2021, two trains collided in Sindh, killing at least 65 people and injuring some 150 others. Between 2013 and 2019, around 150 people died in such incidents. A short while ago, we're joined from Karachi by our correspondent, Mohammed Touré. He told us how the lack of funding in successive governments has left Pakistan's railway network antiquated and in poor condition.
All the operations, the uptrack operations, are ceased. There are long queues on the railway stations like at Karachi and the other cities' railway stations, where the long queues of the people, of the passengers, have been witnessed because the tracks have been seized for the time because of this incident. And of course, this is not the first incident. We saw burnings before, we saw derailments before, and one of the main causes that the main investment which is required and been long overdue and for the structural changes, for the structural improvement, is lacking here. And not just in this government, but in the previous government as well, we witnessed multiple incidents of train derailments on this main track. And let me also tell you that this is the British time railway track, which hasn't been upgraded or changed much since. So these are the consequences that we are seeing right now.
Now, with that report, we come to the end of this broadcast.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Six Muslim organizations in Canada have filed a lawsuit in a court in the province of Quebec calling for a recent provincial order that prohibits all forms of prayer in public schools to be declared unconstitutional. The groups are seeking a judicial review of the ban, arguing that the order is discriminatory against Muslims and violates the right to freedom of religion and of association. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International wrote in this regard, Quebec's war on Islam and Muslims continues. Its latest assault is the ban announced by the Quebec Education Minister, Bernard Drainville, on Muslim prayer rooms in public schools. Adding insult to injury, the ban was announced on April 5th, in the middle of the month of Ramadan. Drainville cited the province's policy on institutional secularism. He should have been a little more honest and admitted that it was because of the province's policy of institutional racism, especially against Muslims. After all, Quebec's Bill 21 forbids government employees and teachers from displaying any religious symbols while at work. This prohibition specifically targets Muslim women and girls wearing hijab. Islamic organizations and mosques in Quebec were outraged by the prayer room ban and launched a court challenge. Unfortunately, even judges have been infected by the Islamophobia virus. Justice Lucas Granosek of the Quebec Superior Court on June 14th denied a request to suspend the province's ban on prayer rooms in public schools. The case against the ban was lodged by the Canadian Civil Liberties Association and the National Council of Canadian Muslims. They had argued that the ban was causing irreparable harm to Muslim students and needed to be suspended immediately. Muslim students couldn't wait while the wider legal challenge made its way through the courts, they said. While the judge acknowledged that the ban violates religious freedom and could cause irreparable harm to Muslim students, he didn't see the urgency of the matter. He advanced the strange argument that groups hadn't demonstrated the need for urgency because they only filed their requests for a stay in June when the ban went into effect on May 3rd. Judge Gronisk told the court on June 14th, as reported by the Canadian press, the delay is not explained in the proceedings and remains inexplicable. The judge admitted that there are serious questions about the constitutionality of the ban, but added that those would be settled during a full trial. He said the constitutional violations were not sufficiently clear for him to suspend the rule so early in the legal challenge. Judge also said it is not clear that the student would be immediately harmed by the rule because classes had ended and the students were only required to be at school to write exams. When Quebec Education Minister first announced the ban on April 5th, Muslim organizations in Quebec expressed outrage. In a joint press release the following day on April 6, representatives of several mosques expressed their indignation at the minister's decision. The mosques are members of the Table de Concertation des Organismes Musulmans. They wrote, "We are also indignant that this decision is made in the middle of Ramadan, a month of blessings, fasting, meetings with all fellow citizens, and prayers for Muslim citizens of Quebec." The authors represent the Islamic Cultural Center of Quebec, the Islamic Association of Rimouski, the Islamic Cultural Association of Eastern Townships, the Association of Muslims of Greater Lévis, MAC Quebec, the Sociocultural Islamic Association, Louvervoie and Belle Aguirre Quebec. It needs recalling that the Islamic Cultural Center of Quebec was subjected to a terrorist attack on January 29, 2017. Six worshippers were shot and killed by Alexander Bissonnette while they were offering their nightly prayer. Another 19 were injured, one paralyzed from the waist down. Bissonnette was sentenced to life prison on 6 counts of murder, but the Supreme Court of Canada ruled that he would be eligible for parole for 25 years. Also, Middle East Eye reported recently, Islamophobia is deeply entrenched in Canadian society and black hijab-wearing women are the most vulnerable. A Canadian Senate committee report says, far-right and anti-Muslim hate groups are growing in Canada, along with incidents of hate, according to a report by the Senate Committee on Human Rights. The report is set to be released in its entirety in July. Police reported hate crimes against Muslim communities across Canada increased by 71% in 2021 alone, with around 8 incidents per 100 Muslims, Statistics Canada reported last year. Canada has a problem, Committee Chair Senator Salma Atolojin said recently in a phone interview with the Canadian press. where she discussed the unreleased report, adding, "We are hearing of intergenerational trauma because young kids are witnessing this. Muslims are speaking out because there are so many attacks happening and they are so violent." The committee also found that attacks against Muslims often take place in public, for example, on the streets, and appear to be more violent than attacks targeting other religious groups. They also found that far-right and anti-Muslim hate groups are some of the driving factors behind these attacks against Muslims. Earlier this month, Muslims in Canada called for more protection and a serious engagement with Islamophobia after a man entered a mosque brandishing a weapon, threatened congregants, damaged mosque property, and tried to run over worshippers in the parking lot. A 28-year-old was arrested and is facing several criminal offenses. In 2020, a mosque caretaker was killed in the Toronto area, while 3 years earlier, a gunman killed 6 Muslim men at a mosque in Quebec City. But the Senate committee began its work in June 2021 after 4 members of a Muslim family were killed when a pickup truck ran over them as they were taking an evening walk in London, Ontario. Currently, a man is facing terror-related charges for the killings.
Your horse returns to Alcamp Riderless.
أزور سيدي ومولاي ومعتمدي ورجاي.
The ocean of dua.
الإمام الحسين.
Why did you leave us to fend for ourselves? Hussein, Hussein, the slain.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Madarisi, and in this edition of The Ocean of Dua, we are trying to discuss and talk about the different aspects of Ziyarat Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, Ziyarat al-Ashura. So stay with us.
ولعن الله أمتان أسرجت والجمات وتهيأت وتنقبت لقتالك.
Brothers and sisters, we were discussing this part of Ziyarat al-Ashura. بأبي أنت وأمي. May my father and mother be sacrificed for you. لقد عظم مصابي بك. Indeed, my affliction due to what happened to you is immense. Regarding this phrase, لقد عظم مصابي بك, we said that if we understand the true meaning of sorrow by realizing the different characteristics as well as the lifestyle of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, our sorrow would be so praiseworthy that it will be equal to glorification and tasbih. And tasbih means passing and moving fast in the path of truth without deviation in the worship of the Almighty Allah. That is why Imam Ridha alayhi salam, alluding to the powerful spiritual effect of sorrow and happiness for the sorrow and happiness of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, says to Ibn Shabib, he says, O son of Shabib, إن سرك أن تكون معنا في الدرجات العلا من الجنان فاحزن لحزننا وافرح لفرحنا وعليك بولايتنا. O son of Shabib, if it pleases you to be with us in the lofty stations of the heavens, then be sorrowful for our sorrow, be joyful for our joy, and maintain our guardianship. So, in conclusion of what we have said in the previous episodes, we can say that the state of sorrow and grief for the oppression that afflicted Imam Hussein alayhi salam is a means to spiritual uplift, the grief-stricken. So the grief-stricken, the mahmoom, is the one who can reach these stations. In fact, there are many traditions that allude to this kind of uplifting, this effect of weeping for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. The Holy Prophet sallallahu, for example, is reported to have said, "Kullu man baka minhum ala musab al-Husayn alayhi salam, akhadhna bi yadihi wa adkhalnahu al-jannah." For everyone who weeps among them, I mean the believers, on the affliction of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, we would take his hand, we would place him in Jannah and the heavens.
When people ask, I'm confused about which school is right or which madhab is right, go to Karbala. Look at Karbala, it clarifies it instantaneously. Anybody says, I'm confused, say, please go to Karbala and tell me what happened, why it happened, and what does it have to do with your religion. You will see it completely exemplifies, it clarifies, it takes all the blurs out instantaneously. SubhanAllah, that's the miracle of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Imam Hussein alayhi salam's main foundation of morality is do not allow tyranny, do not allow evil doing, do not allow indecency. Why is Imam like this? Because he knows Allah, he appreciates him, he understands his dimensions. That's why we must love them so much. We must love them so much that don't let anybody else take us away from them. There should be no room in our thoughts. No matter who we admire in this world, no matter how great a person we look at, never move the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt out of the center of the heart. Never. They will know that their Khalifa lied to them because he told them they don't pray. And if they see them praying on the battlefield, their hearts will change. So stop them from praying. Imagine how evil these people were. That's how much lies they had. And you cannot eradicate this lie at the level that we are talking about unless you give your blood for the love of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Dear listeners, for the remainder of this episode, let us have a look at the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt regarding the importance of weeping for Imam Hussein. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam has said, "Our Shias are from us. Shi'atuna minna, wa qad khuliqu min fadhli tilatina." And indeed, they have been created from the remainder of our clay. Imam continues, "They are mixed with the light of our guardianship. They are pleased with us as divine leader, and we are pleased with them as our Shias. Whatever afflicts us, afflicts them, and our afflictions make them weep. Our grief grieves them, our happiness makes them happy, and we likewise are hurt when they are hurt, and we come to know of their states. Whosoever remembers our affliction and weeps for us, Allah is ashamed to punish him with the fire of hell. فَمَنْ ذَكَرَ مُصَابَنَا وَبَكَى لِأَجْلِنَا إِسْتَحْيَ اللَّهُ أَنْ يُعَذِّبَهُ بِالنَّارِ." Elsewhere, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam has said, "For everything there is a reward, save a tear for us." So Imam says that a tear, out of understanding and recognition for the Ahlul Bayt, for the affliction they went through, this is priceless. Addressing the poet Di'b al-Khuza'i, Imam Rida alayhi salam says, Ya Di'bil, man baka ala musabi jaddi al-Husayn alayhi salam, ghafarallahu lahu dhunubahu. O Di'bil, whosoever weeps on the affliction of my grandfather Hussein, Allah will forgive his sins. On the importance of weeping for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and the fact that tears for Imam Hussein is priceless, Imam Baqir alayhi salam is reported to have said, كان علي بن الحسين عليهما السلام يقول أيما مؤمن دمعت عيناه لقتل الحسين بن علي عليهما السلام دمعة حتى تسيل على خده بوأه الله بها في الجنة غرفا يسكنها أحقاب. علي بن الحسين would say, any believer whose eyes shed a single tear for the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, Ibn Ali, to the extent that it rolls down his cheek, Allah will thereby settle him down in rooms in heaven where he would abide for ages. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
أنت الذي صنعت من الرمح منبرا ظمآن والزمان بعينيك ممطرا نعم الأمير أنت حسين وقدوتي ساروا إليك قلبي وعقلي ودمعتي يا محيي الكرامة تبكيك كل عين لبيك يا إمامي لبيك يا حسين الروح بالدم
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
British Petroleum has reported $2.6 billion in profits after hottest month on record. Climate advocates note that oil and gas profits are soaring like the temperature increases they are responsible for. This is while Britons are struggling with the cost of living crisis. According to new reports, England is facing a homelessness crisis, with the number of people living in temporary accommodation in England at a 25-year high. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout noted, the London-based oil giant BP reported second-quarter profits of $2.6 billion and announced a 10% dividend raise for shareholders on the heels of what was likely the hottest month on record, a grim milestone that scientists say was made possible by the burning of fossil fuels. While BP's profits for the second quarter of 2023 were far lower than the massive $8.5 billion it logged during the same period last year, a drop caused by falling global oil prices, the company has still raked in $7.6 billion in profits so far this year. The company has set out those profits to investors in the form of share buybacks and dividends. BP said in its earnings announcement that it will repurchase another $1.5 billion worth of its shares over the next 3 months. Jonathan Norona Gant, a senior campaigner at Global Witness, said in a statement recently, in 2021, BP CEO described his company as a cash machine after soaring oil and gas prices boosted profits. Nearly 2 years on, and BP is riding the wave of the energy crisis and handing huge sums of money to its shareholders while the UK's poverty rates spiral. This is what a broken energy system looks like. Oil giants get richer because the rest of us get poorer. Gant added, for BP, the energy crisis has been a giant cash grab. For parents across the country, it has been an impossible choice between feeding their children and paying their bills. BP's earnings report comes as its rival Shell posted $5.1 billion in second quarter profits last week and announced a dividend boost of 15% amid a deadly global heat wave. Nicolo Wojewoda, Europe Regional Director at 350.org, said recently that you would think that those most responsible for the hottest month in recorded human history are being held accountable. Think again. Fossil fuel companies, instead of facing consequences, continue being rewarded with record-breaking annual profits, having cashed in more than $200 billion in 2022 alone. He added, fossil fuel industry profits are soaring alongside the rise in global temperatures they are responsible for. This must end now. We must hold them accountable for the damage they have inflicted, making them pay for it and phasing their dangerous influence out of existence. Recently, a group of U.S. lawmakers led by Senator Bernie Sanders urged the Biden Justice Department to sue fossil fuels companies for leading a decades-long, carefully coordinated campaign of misinformation to obfuscate climate science and convince the public that fossil fuels are not the primary driver of climate change. BP knew about the link between fossil fuels and climate change for years before it began publicly acknowledging the connection and styling itself as a renewable energy leader, a posture it has since abandoned. Like Shell and other oil giants, BP recently walked back some of its stated emission reduction targets and announced plans to produce more fossil fuels than previously expected. Earlier this year, BP said it intends to cut fossil fuel production by 25% below 2019 levels by decade's end instead of its previous goal of 40%. Dorothy Guerrero, head of policy and advocacy at the UK-based group Global Justice Now, said in response to the recent earnings results that once again BP has raked in highest profits as our planet burns, from people struggling with the cost of living crisis in the UK to communities on the front line of climate disasters in the global south. We're all footing the bill for the reckless profiteering of the fossil fuel industry. Adding, enough is enough. The government must stop turning a blind eye as shareholders line their pockets at our collective expense. It's time to bring in a permanent polluter's tax to hold BP and other fossil fuel companies to account for the damage they continue to wreak. Leaving this industry with the power to profit without consequence is not only morally abhorrent, it's plainly ludicrous in the face of a climate catastrophe that threatens us all. Meanwhile, Press TV reported England is facing a homelessness crisis, with the number of people living in temporary accommodation in England at a 25-year high. Over 104,000 households were in temporary accommodation by the end of March 2023, the highest number since records began in 1998. This is indicative of a 10% jump of homeless people in England compared to last year. Official data shows that 9,520 more households have been placed in temporary accommodation since 2022. Over 131,000 children are also in temporary accommodation, the highest figure on record. Almost 14,000 households were in hotels or bed and breakfast accommodation in the 3 months ending in March. Official figures also show a sharp rise in homelessness in older people in the year ending on the 31st of March and a 33.3% increase in the number of homeless households with a priority need due to old age. Experts say loss of private tenancy is a leading cause of homelessness. Instability in the private rental market, exacerbated in the short term by rising interest rates and mortgage payment increases, has led to steep rent rises and property owners deciding to sell their properties. Campaigners say a lack of housing, exacerbated by decision by the ministers to freeze local housing allowance rates for the past 3 years, also lies at the root of the problem. The number of UK households being issued with no-fault evictions has also risen in the past year, with a 21% increase in those at the risk of homelessness due to a no-fault eviction. The British government has also frozen the local housing allowance at 2020 levels. This is the amount which people claiming household benefits who rent privately are entitled to.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be examining a question which is very significant and very pertinent for all of us today, especially a lot of us who are actively involved in, Islamic communities, in centers, and in mosques, and in these kind of places. And that question is about the reciprocal duties and rights between the imam and the community that that imam leads. And a lot of people ask this question because there's kind of a ambiguity regarding this subject. People kind of are misinformed about this subject. And because of that, you know, a lot of the efforts which are made, in the advancement of the Islamic, message and the Islamic cause, you know, they turn out to be unfruitful. One of the reasons could be this. In respect to this question, we can take reference and inspiration from the hadith. Certainly the hadith of Imam Ali, he has a lot of hadith regarding this subject. In one beautiful hadith, the imam, enumerating these rights and these duties, he says, "It is the duty of an imam to rule in accordance with what Allah has revealed, and that he delivers what he has been entrusted with. If he does that, then it is the duty of the people to listen to him and to obey him and to hearken to his call when they are called." So this, in this hadith, the imam says that, you know, if a person has sufficient knowledge of Islam and, you know, he rules according to these laws of Islam and he is trustful and trustworthy and he delivers these trusts that he has been entrusted with and the duties that he has been entrusted with, then it is the obligation and duty of the people to listen to him. And a lot of the problems that we have in, you know, in these communities, a lot of it stems from this fact. So, you know, a lot of, you know, people in, you know, in places, they, you know, they bring a person in, you know, with the idea that this person is going to be the, you know, the imam of this community or whatever. They end up, you know, doing whatever they want. You know, they come up to their own decisions, you know, instead of seeking his advice and looking into inspiration from him with respect to Islamic matters and the propagation of Islam, they run off and, you know, kind of do their own thing. And, you know, we can illustrate the, you know, erroneousness of this this matter with a simple example. Let's say that, you know, you go to a doctor, right? And, you know, you do some research and you look for a good doctor who has good expertise in a certain subject. And, you know, you go and you seek his advice out for a certain medical problem. But after the doctor gives the advice, you know, and you spend all this money, you know, going to the doctor and stuff, you decide after that to, you know, to do whatever you want and to come to a decision, a personal decision on your own, even though you don't have, you know, the right qualifications to do so. This would be, if you told any human being that you did such a thing, the person would, you know, would be astonished, and, you know, he would probably laugh at you. And so the same thing goes, you know, in this case, right? If we have, you know, called a certain person with certain, qualifications, right? With the understanding that this person would be performing a certain function, and we have, you know, spent all these funds and all these, you know, resources and bringing the person there, right? But we end up, you know, following our own, assumptions or our own, come to our own decisions regarding these matters, right? This is something which is humorous and actually astonishment. And, you know, it's contrary to kind of the advice that the Imam alayhi salam gives us here in this hadith. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the reciprocal duties and rights between the Imam and the community in the words of Imam Ali alayhi salam, and in the light of the hadith and the Quranic verses. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.